On this episode of Still Loading, the Sega Pico. Hello everyone, this is Josh and welcome to this new episode of Still Loading. This is the last episode actually before the summer of PlayStation 2 starts. The summer of PS2 is here next week, starting on a weekly basis. Literally next week. You don't even have to wait 2 weeks for the first episode. Next week will be the first episode of the summer of PS2, and I'm so excited for you all to hear it. It is going to be, I guess, to kind of not too much of a surprise, but the first episode is going to be on the original Jak and Daxter game. You may have remembered years ago, probably one of my earliest episodes, over 100 episodes ago now, was the Jak and Daxter trilogy. Well, that was when I first started out, and I'd really love to revisit the games in general. So some of these games on this list on over the summer of the PS2, I've already talked about, but I really wanted to do them justice. So that's starting next week, which I'm very excited about. Now, this episode here, if you couldn't already tell by the time, I'm assuming is, we'll see what happens when this is all said and done, but it's going to be a short episode. There's a number of reasons for that. One, I'm just tired. I did a lot of work in prep for the summer of PS2, and I've actually been streaming a lot. If you guys want to see me stream, you can check it out, Still Loading Pod on Twitch. Easy to find, just like all my social media handles, Still Loading Pod, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Maybe I'll do that now so I don't have to do it later on. And that's not the main reason. The last 2 weeks have been real rough for me. I won't go into detail because I don't really want to burden anyone with this. And plus, it's not really, but not 100% appropriate, I guess, to say on a podcast. But I just lost a family member. It'll be a little over a week ago from the time you're hearing this, which actually I'm recording this the night before. So actually, yeah, it's just a little over a week ago. And I'm still pretty sad about it. So doing my best to soldier on. A lot of the episodes that you're going to hear for the summer of PS2 were recorded well in advance. So pre-COVID, pre-everything else. So it's a very different time when those are recorded. But I digress. So this episode, I wanted to kind of, it was going to be a little bit shorter. And I wanted to talk about the Sega Pico, and the reason is, and you'll, for those who don't know what the Sega Pico is, I'll go into it, but the reason is that I don't know anyone who knows about this console. So when I have a topic like this, it's always something that's better reserved for a short episode, because it's hard for me to just kind of expouse random, like, you know, just constant stream of consciousness, like just constantly talking can be difficult sometimes, and I'm not always the greatest at it. But I want to do it on this episode. I wanted to do the Sega Pico because, like I said, I don't know anyone who knows about this. So I would love to, you know me, I love video game history. I really love talking about it. I really love researching it. I really love learning more about game history. And the Sega Pico is a really interesting footnote in Sega's history, in video game history, because it was one of the only times where one of the major video game developers really pushed their hand into edutainment. There's tons of edutainment software out there, you know, stuff that is done by, like, what is it? I think Humongous Entertainment or Humongous Entertainment is a company that did like the Pajama Sam and a couple others like edutainment. I can't think of it, like point and click edutainment games. Other designers like from Carmen Sandiego and Oregon Trail and all this good stuff. Like, you don't really see console manufacturers go for it. It's usually individual game developers. And the Sega Pico is interesting because Sega actually made this. So let's kind of dive into it, right? So the Sega Pico was released in Japan in June of 1993, and it wasn't released outside of Japan until over a year later, in November of 94 in North America, and I'm not sure about the time, but sometime in 1994 in Europe as well. And Sega Pico was interesting. So first off, the hardware behind the console is the same that's in the Sega Genesis, but the physical shape of the Pico is very different. It was actually shaped to be designed like a laptop. So you open it up and you open it up like you would a laptop, and you plug AV cables into your TV, and then you plug an AC adapter into the outlet, right? Now, what was cool about the Sega Pico is that the cartridges weren't what you would consider cartridges. They were called storyware, and what they were actually is that they were storybooks. They were books that were mounted on top of video game cartridges. So what you would do is you would put the cartridge into the cartridge slot, but the book was right up on top. So imagine, I'm trying to find a good way to describe it. You have like an NES cartridge, right? But instead of all that extra empty space up in the top of the NES cartridge, they just kind of take the plastic and they expand it out to put a book right up on top there. So you plug that cartridge into the cartridge slot, which actually, if you're thinking of it like a laptop, it'd be where the screen is at. You plug it, you pop it in, and you click it back into place, and then you open the book. Once you open you turn the console on, and what you see on the page is what you see on the screen. And as you flip the page, that will actually change what you see on the screen to match what is on the very next page. It's really inventive for how they did it. I'm not 100% certain of the technology, but it seems to me like they have light sensors where the pages have tabs at the top, and as you fold away the pages, it reveals more and more light sensors. So the game cartridge knows, okay, there's 3 light sensors showing light. That means I have to be on this page. Or there's 2 light sensors showing light. That means they're only on the second page of the cartridge, if that makes sense. So the console was super fascinating with how it, like, just the idea of it, where it was a book that you could throw up onto your TV screen and interact with it. Now, it had a stylus, but they didn't call it a stylus. They called it a magic pen. And pretty much you would tap the magic pen onto either the book, literally the book where like the laptop screen would be, onto the book pages itself, or onto a little pad that's on the bottom, and you could interact with the game that way. They usually had coloring applications. They had tons of different like puzzle software, that kind of stuff. I saw a lot of coloring stuff. I actually have a boxed Pico along with a handful of boxed games. And in North America, it didn't sell very well. It did much better in Japan. And in fact, it even got a sequel console, which was technically Sega's last video game console. It was called the Bina, and it was released in 2005, but it was only released in Japan, which is why no one really talks about that as Sega's last console. Everyone thinks of the Dreamcast as their last console, excuse me. So the Pico, there's tons of different games for it. Most of them were released in Japan. There's some interesting ones, though. What was fascinating to me was just the sheer amount of Disney stuff that's on it in the U.S. I have a Pocahontas game. I have a Winnie the Pooh game. I have a Little Mermaid game, or edutainment type of game. There's tons of stuff like that. It's really interesting to me to see what got made for it. One of my personal favorites, The Busy World of Richard Scarry. I loved that cartoon as a kid, and they have a game for it, for the Pico. When the Pico was released, I probably should have gone into this a little bit. The Pico sold for approximately $160 upon launch, but it was eventually released, it was advertised at $160, but eventually released at $139, or about $140, right? The cartridges or the storyware were sold for $40 to $50, or $39.99 to $49.99, and their slogan was, "The computer that thinks it's a toy." And in fact, it was designed, it was an offshoot of Sega. It was developed and manufactured by Sega Toys, and so not Sega itself, but just a slight offshoot of it. But it is part of Sega, obviously. So it was manufactured by Sega Toys. And Sega Toys is interesting because it used to be Yonezawa Toys, which was the largest post-war toy manufacturer in Japan. But then it was later absorbed into Sega in 1991, pretty much at the height of Sega's success. And what's crazy about the Pico is that it got released in 93, which, at that time, that is the height of Sega fandom in the world. You had the Genesis / Mega Drive. It was called the Mega Drive in other regions, you know, Europe and the PAL regions and in Japan specifically. It was only really called the Genesis for us, which personally I'm preferential to, but that's just me. Maybe it's nostalgia. I don't know. What do you all think? Mega Drive versus Genesis. Like I said, I prefer Genesis, but that's just me. That was out. They were still supporting the Sega Game Gear, which was, you know, their competition for the Game Boy. They had their hands in everything, and that's a very Sega thing to do. Sega had their hands in so much. They tried so many unique and crazy things. Unfortunately, that is probably what doomed the company to not be able to make consoles anymore. They tried too much. It's kind of crazy to think about. They didn't play it safe. Sega very seldomly played it safe, and I kind of commend them for that. But anyway, so there's a ton of games for the Pico, which I know I mentioned before, but just to name a few, and probably one of the more interesting ones in my opinion, I already talked about, you know, Busy World, which is scary, and all the Disney ones. They actually had an Echo Jr. For those who remember Echo the Dolphin for the Genesis, this was Echo Jr. in the Great Ocean Treasure Hunt. That there was a game that was an edutainment game kind of involving, you know, Echo Jr. And it was just a bunch of counting games and like counting mini games, color mini games, just trying to teach kids basics like that. They actually had a Magic School Bus game, which I'm a huge fan of. It was only released in North America in 1995. So I actually kind of want to search for it and get my hands on that. They also had a Sonic game. Of course, no Sega console would be complete without a Sonic game. They had Sonic the Hedgehog's Game World and then Tails and the Music Maker. I don't know if that was actually a Sonic game, but it might have been because I can't click on it right now. Probably one of the craziest things, though, in 2002. So this is after the Dreamcast, right? Sega and Nintendo were kind of ish working together now because Sega was out of the console game. But they released a Pokemon game for the Sega Pico. It was only in Japan on July 23rd, 2002. Pocket Monster Suichi O Tsukameyu. I hope I said that correctly. That was actually developed by Sega Toys and published by Sega for the Sega Pico. That's crazy. That's just nuts to me to think that there is a Pokemon game for this. And it's probably one of the few Pokemon games a lot of people don't know about. I didn't actually know about it until doing research for this episode. But there's, you know, in terms of the Disney stuff, once again, there's Mickey's Blast into the Past. There's Math Antics with 101 Dalmatians. There's a Lego game. There's a lot in Japan. There's a Lion King game as well. Sorry, there's just so many. But there's so many different things. There's a Berenstain Bears game. There's just so many different, you know, famous kid brands that were made into games for this console. And it's crazy to me that it just never really picked up steam, because I'm looking at it now. I mean, granted, it's with eyes from, you know, it's with 2020 eyes, but like, it's crazy to me how advanced that console was. The fact that you had a touchscreen kids edutainment console that you could flip pages on and it would change what's on the screen. It's just wild to me that it didn't succeed. I was watching a YouTuber, and I do want to give him some credit real quick, because he brought up a really good point. Let me try to find his video again real quick. Just so it was Top Hat Gaming Man. So I want to make sure I give him credit. He brought up a very good point that Sega's marketing campaign in the 90s was all about how they were pretty much too cool for school. Like, I hate that phrase now. That's so dated. But it was all about how they were the cool console. Nintendo was for little kids and Sega was for the edgy adults. Yeah. And that was their marketing campaign. That's what they kind of hitched their wagon to. So it would have been very hard for Sega to be able to market an edutainment console from that same company in North America, at least. That marketing campaign didn't really apply too much out of North America and maybe Europe. I would have to, any European gamers out there, let me know if Sega really went for an edgy marketing campaign in Europe as well. I know they did in North America, but I'd be curious about Europe. He brought up a good point. Top Hat Gaming Man on YouTube. His video is actually a little over a year old now. Almost a year old now. He brought up a good point saying that, you know, that was the reason probably why it was hard for them to market it in the US. And I would agree with that. Some final notes, because like I said, this is going to be a shorter episode. I'm actually amazed right now. My timer is at 16 minutes after I edit out some coughs and some stumblings and fumblings. It's going to be shorter than that, obviously. But one of the last things I want to talk about is the look of the Sega Pico. If I said Pico, by the way, at all during this, I apologize. That's how I used to pronounce it, but it should be pronounced Pico. It looks like it's just the American in me, I guess. It's Pico is how it looks to me, but it's pronounced Pico. The Pico had one of the most 90s color schemes I've ever seen. It's this teal green with, it's the, like, if you're looking at it like it's a laptop that you open up, right? The bottom where the keyboard is teal green, and the top where the actual monitor would be is this 90s purple, and all the text and everything, like the Magic Pen and the Pico text and everything is in this bright yellow, like this sunflower yellow is the best way I can describe it. The Pico is just such a, it's a relic of the 90s, but it's like just such a cool relic, you know? I actually, whenever my friends and I hang out, we do a gaming night, or before COVID hit, we used to do a gaming night at least once a month, maybe every other month. And I brought it one time. I wouldn't, you know, it's not something we're going to sit around and be like, hey guys, let's play Sega Pico today. Let's play some edutainment games for 8-year-olds. It's not the most interesting thing, but when you're looking at it as more of like an educational historical type of thing, it's pretty fascinating the fact that a console from 1993 had a touchscreen. And admittedly, it wasn't quite exactly the same of what we know a touchscreen to be, where you're actually touching a screen and you're interacting with objects on that screen, versus this, you're touching a surface and it's interacting with something on the TV. The surface is just connected to the TV via AV cables. And just in general, this is just fascinating to me. When I was doing research for this, according to the former hardware research and development head, Hideki Sato, he said that their cartridges were, the development of the Pico was actually possible due to their work on the SG-1000 system. Now, real quick history lesson, before Sega ever made it to the US or North America, and maybe even outside of Japan in general, I would have to ask any PAL region or European users to be certain, the Sega Master System was the first Sega console outside of Japan, as far as I'm aware. Let me just double check that to make sure I'm not screwing that up. And I'm glad I did, because the SG-1000 was released outside of Japan. It was actually released in Australia, which is very interesting. So the SG-1000 was their first home console, and then there was the SG-2000 and then the SG-3000. The SG-3000 is what became the Sega Master System, but the SG-1000 is what they started off with. And it's just kind of crazy to think about what it, like where Sega started and how they ended up. It's just interesting to me. I would love to get my hands on an SG-1000, man, just because that's such a unique, weird time in gaming. And it was like we know so little about it here in the States. So I think it'd be fun to get my hands on it. But anyway, so in the SG-1000, they had these things called My Cards, which are pretty much just these little cartridges that they actually did use on the Sega Master System in the US as well, but they're little tiny cartridges just for small games. They were alternative to cartridges, and they were designed by Sega, and they were used with the SG-1000, the Sega Mark III, and the Sega Master System. And the latter two used cards named with the Sega My Card Mark III in Japan. I'm reading this off of SegaRetro.org, excuse me. So yeah, that is really all I had on the Sega Pico. I know it was kind of like a little bit more loose format. I didn't have time to write a script, like I said. Like I said at the beginning of the episode, it's been a rough week. I wanted something kind of fun and easy to do, something a little bit different, and something to kind of go back to video game history, not just talk about individual video games, but talk about a concept or talk about something kind of a little bit more nebulous and something so specific. Because for the next couple months, you're going to be getting a lot of PS2, a lot of different PS2 games. I have a lot of different guests for them. I'm very excited. I don't have them all recorded. As of now, I actually have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 9, Hold on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, 9. 11 episodes recorded. That might actually, I think I counted on a previous episode, and I don't think that number's changed. But I'm actually in the process of messaging people today to set some more dates in stone, because I actually have episodes recorded up until August, which is fantastic to think about. Anyway. But yeah, so I wanted to talk about something that's a little bit lesser known, even among gaming enthusiasts. Not a lot of people know about the Sega Pico, just because it had such a small amount, small foothold. It didn't even have a foothold really in North America. And on top of that, it's not an expensive thing to collect for, because it's not highly sought after. Not a lot of people have memories of it. So because of that, and on top of the fact that it sold well enough to not make it completely rare, but also not too well to make it be sought after, so it's in that awkward in the middle type of thing, where it's just not a popular system. But I'm fascinated by it, and I really enjoy showing people the Pico, because it's just such an oddity. It's Sega. It screams Sega from the 90s, and I really love that. So that wraps it up for this episode of Still Loading. Thank you all once again for listening. As usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Still Loading Pod on all of them. If you want to help the show out, there's a couple ways you can do that. The easiest way, and it would only cost a moment of your time, is just to give it a rating review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That helps get exposure for the show, so that way more people can find it. If you would like to support it monetarily, Not required, obviously. I put this out because I love doing it. But if you want to support my work, you can go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. And probably the most important thing I shout out is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at hospitals. Check them out at bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating if you can. That should do it for this episode. Thank you all once again for listening, and I will see you all next time.